We only have two things on our agenda today, members. One is an informational meeting, and then the second is a discussion of the DEQ draft that I have done based on the hearings that we had up in Sherwood from a couple of weeks ago. But first, I would like to have the DAS folks come up. We've got Don Fleming with us, and then we also have Bill Fink with us. And what I've asked them to talk a little bit about is relative to the assessments and the fees, and I know that Bill has some, may have some handouts for us and some charts and that sort of thing that we want to discuss a little bit surrounding those. And Don, are you kind of separate from Bill? Why don't we have you go ahead and start then?
Fine. For the record, my name is Don Fleming. I'm state CIO. I report to Lori Warner, who's the acting director of the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
You would like for me to Chair Kremel, you would like for me to review the security situation, the immediate action plan status? Is that what you're...
But here's what the question is, Don. I got a report back that not from an agency, but just from some other sources, and they were questioning the state security plan. And I know that this is pretty sensitive information, so we're not going to ask you questions specific to, you know, like what kind of hardware, software, or what vulnerabilities were found and all that kind of stuff. But what my concern is that JLCIMT, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, made a recommendation to the e-board in January that e-board free up $8 million for this project. And my understanding is that was never put out to bid, but in fact a contract was let to a company without any kind of a competitive bid. And I would like to kind of dig down a little bit on this and find out why it is that it was never put out to competitive bid, and what does that do to us from a standpoint of the hardware and software and that sort of thing, and does it, you know, put us in a situation of only being able to procure one kind.
Right.
I think we need to be very sensitive to the issues, members, surrounding competition. There is a lot of competition out there for state business, because generally the state pays its bills, and I think that's why companies like to do business with the state. So that's...
Yes, sir. Right. Chair Kremel, members of the committee, let me just give you a brief background. As some of you know, and certainly Representative Kremel knows very well, the state performed a comprehensive vulnerability assessment last year. Based on that assessment, the 12 agency directors, the JLCIMT, members of the JLCIMT, the governor's office all concurred that we had a situation that required immediate action. And so we can say that speed was of the essence to react to the findings. So we created what we called an immediate action plan. The initiatives in that plan were selected based on the following criteria. They would provide the absolute maximum reduction in risk exposure for the state in the minimum amount of time. And that's how those actions were selected. The four areas, and I'll try to give you enough information so we can get at the issue you want to get at without giving so much information that we're really disclosing our security strategy in more detail than we'd like to. But the four areas that we pursued was the construction of a perimeter. And one of the key elements of the strategy, and it was deliberate, and we reviewed this with JLCIMT, is we timed it so that we would be able to inform the scenic project, the data center network consolidation project, about the risk exposure that was inherent in the current computing and networking infrastructure, so that could be addressed as part of the scenic project. And so one of the first things that went into this plan, it was very obvious, was the establishment of a perimeter. if you like, a wall around the state's computing and networking infrastructure that would do two things for us. It would hide that infrastructure from the internet, so it would not be visible as targets. And number two, it would allow us to block hostile or threatening traffic coming in from the internet in the event it was detected. It's a very obvious thing to do, but it required urgency, that it be done as quickly as possible. In terms of the, and I'll just try to go through these, if that's all right with you, one at a time, very quickly.
Please.
The vendor decision there is based on a couple of things. One, if you look at the installed base, okay, most of the network appliances that are installed in the state of Oregon today, the routers and switches and stuff like that, come from Cisco. Cisco is a world-class vendor. There are other good vendors. But in order to move this as quickly as possible and be able to ensure that it would all play together, so that when we put the perimeter in, it would work with the rest of the network, we went with Cisco technology. Okay? We did not put that out for a competitive bid. If we had gone through a competitive bid process, that would have taken a significant portion of the time we had available in this biennium. One of the bargain we made with the legislature is that we would implement these initiatives and put them in place and begin to establish some risk exposure reduction this biennium. And those funds were to be expended this biennium to create the capabilities and the increased security.
Let me stop you for just a second. When you talk about Cisco, now does Cisco operate through, are they working with you directly then on a direct, or are they going through one of their resellers?
Chair Kremel, I'll have to get back to you on that. I think that they are coming through a reseller, but I'm not sure. I don't have the answer to that, but I will get it for you. Okay. So we already had an established investment in technology and in this particular vendor in our networks that had occurred over the years. And I want to mention one other thing to you. When you do a data center network consolidation project, the absolute last thing you do is to change the technology or the architecture unless it is absolutely required in order to accomplish consolidation. What you're doing a consolidation for is to save money. What you don't want to do is to add elements of risk by bringing in technology that nobody's familiar with while you're in the middle of lifting your 12 largest data centers and consolidating them into a brand new data center that you've built. So you try to keep as few variables as possible, okay, moving during a consolidation. And so the decision to go with in the perimeter technology with Cisco was made for those reasons, which I think are pretty straightforward reasons, given the installed base and the need for all of this stuff to work together and the urgency for establishing the perimeter so that we could reduce our risk exposure. The second area, as in the area of identity and access management, one of the problems we have is that knowing that you are who you say you are and that you are supposed to be able to access our systems. And the technology that helps us get at and address that problem, which is a big problem for us, is called identity and access management. Now, it turns out that DHS, for reasons of their own, had begun a very substantial and aggressive effort in this area and had selected technology based on requirements and so forth. And what we did was, in the interest of speed and in taking advantage of the progress that DHS had already made, we based our technology strategy on the one that DHS had selected. And it was clearly scalable to the entire enterprise. And rather than force DHS to reverse out of the work that they had done and not take advantage of that work, given that they had picked world-class technology, this is top of the line technical strategy, and in the interest of time and best use of work already done, we used that same technology, which was basically IBM Tivoli technology, to support the identity. Now, these are the main technology decisions. There's other tiny stuff, but these are the big decisions. So we went with with a DHS technical strategy. And this was has been reviewed by the technology committees that advise the scenic project that involved CIOs and subject matter experts from other agencies. This is not just an exclusively a DAS decision. For those of you that are familiar with the scenic project, there are considerable resources from the participating agencies involved in making these kinds of decisions and vetting these kinds of strategies. And so it was the concurrence of these committees that the wise thing to do, particularly given the interest to move quickly here, was to leverage the investment and progress that DHS had already made.
Let me stop you again, Don. Again, same question that I had about Cisco using the IBM technology, and I don't have anything against either one.
No,
of
I know.
You know. But again, now, is this through a reseller, or are we working with IBM direct? Are we a big enough entity to work with them direct?
Sir, I'm going to have to get back to you with that answer.
At
one time, I know we were discussing procuring this particular technology through EDS, but I'm not sure what the final call was on that, but I will get you an answer.
Please. Okay. Thank you.
The third area is called incident response. And what that's based on is the simple fact that, particularly given the current situation, the state will be attacked, and some of those attacks will be successful. And the point of an incident response team is a team, like a SWAT team, that can be mobilized in the event of an attack. And because what happens in a cybersecurity attack is the length of time between the onset of the attack and the time it takes to contain it and then quash it is directly proportional to the damage and disruption that is done. And so this is a reactive, where these other measures I've been talking about are preventive. This is a reactive measure. All rational cybersecurity programs create this kind of capability. And so, and the vendor that we had been working with, and you're very familiar with this, Chair Kremel, which was Symantec, that did the vulnerability assessments and had is an absolute number one top shelf vendor in the area of security, and had done the vulnerability assessments that were driving this particular plan, also is top in the field, rated top in the field by Gartner Group and other organizations for providing a service in the incident response area in the interest of being able to field a team as quickly as possible. Because if you think about it, our maximum need for having an incident response capability is now, when our program is at its weakest. As the program builds up and strengthens, one might put a slightly lower priority on it. But at this particular point in time, we want to have the ability to respond to cybersecurity attacks if and when they occur. The other thing is associated with this work with Symantec is that they have been placing technology in the network to improve our eyes and ears so that we are more aware of traffic that should be examined more closely and perhaps prevented. So we did not competitively bid that decision, and that was maybe perhaps the most urgent of all of the things we were trying to put in place, was the incident response team that would allow us to respond to an attack. I don't know if anybody here has ever experienced or been in a cybersecurity attack, but they can be really quite scary. And in fact, it happened to me at my last job in Brookhaven. I'd been there about 3 months. We had an attack, and they took the whole network from us, and it took us days and days and days to recover from it. So that's what this kind of a team is for, to respond, that's trained and rehearsed and knows how to deal with a cybersecurity attack. And I think you're familiar with that. The last area, the fourth component, which I think also illustrates some of the problems that we have very well in terms of the complexity and diversity in the installed base of technology in the state, where we have many, many vendors, many, many generations of technology, many, many operating systems, many, many configurations for these systems so that they are almost all unique, which means there's almost no automation strategies available to the state for managing this stuff. It takes a human being to physically go to these boxes and work on them. It's called patch management. Those of you who are familiar with a little bit or read a little bit in the paper and so forth about hackers, what they do is they exploit vulnerabilities that are in the operating systems and configurations of our computers. And those of you who have computers at home may have bought a personal firewall or something like that to help you prevent this. We have, let's say, 50,000 to 55,000 boxes connected to the network. Those boxes are not patched. That means they're not secure, and it means they're visible to the internet. So that's a big, big, obvious thing for us to pay attention to. Now, in the beginning, because we do not have the ability to employ automation techniques because of the complexity and diversity of that installed base, we are required to put people on these problems and do it manually. And so the early stages of the patch management project involve personal services. We're hiring contractors to augment our resources. As time goes by, and it's an urgent problem for us to address, we must standardize that installed base, and we must reduce its complexity and diversity to only that is absolutely required to address the business that the state is conducting. Once we do that, we should be able to dramatically improve our ability to maintain these systems in a secure level, and we should also be able to dramatically reduce the cost of doing that. So these are the things that we're working on that are in the immediate action plan, and they are critical things for us to accomplish as quickly as we can. And the situation with respect to the vendors is, I also am very sensitive to making sure that we provide an open and competitive environment so that we can get the best deals for the state and that we provide fair opportunities to the vendors that have legitimate products that should be considered. This particular series of activities, though, had to be undertaken in an extremely aggressive way, and we were able to get the DAS director to sign an emergency declaration giving us permission to pursue an expedited procurement process, because again, time was absolutely critical here. The kinds of technology that we were locking ourselves into, we were already locked into in terms of installed base and things like that. So it didn't take away our options or choices or alter them from what they had already been in the past. The vendors that we were picking were world-class vendors and world-class technology. It's true there are vendors we didn't pick that are also quite good and have good technology, but to go through that process itself would have taken us more time than we had, because we had the deal we had made with the legislature and made sense in light of the risk exposure that the state had, was that we would establish these capabilities this biennium. Be happy to answer any other questions.
Don, would you say that you are, you know, 20% through the process, 50%, 90%? Where would you gauge where we are in terms of having this so that we do have these critical beginnings in place?
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, where I would say we are is that by the end of this biennium, we will have established either a beginning or initial capability or a fairly solid capability, depending on which initiative we're talking about. In terms of when these are all up and they're all operating well, where will we be? We'll still be probably another couple of years away from being able to deal with all the threats that are out there in an effective way. Now, this is normal. If you want a perspective on this, it generally takes an enterprise something like 2 to 3 years when it's in the situation that we were in to put into place an effective, stable cybersecurity program. It's not something you can just do overnight. We are trying to do it as quickly as we possibly can, and we're going through a triage process again, which is what gives us the maximum risk exposure reduction in the minimum amount of time. I would say that the perimeter is going well. By the way, what the perimeter allows us to do is, before that data center is completed, that we've got under construction right now, we will be able to consolidate the networks of our largest agencies behind that perimeter and hide that technology from the internet before we've even moved the workload into the data center. So I think it's kind of it's a smart plan, and it makes maximum use of Scenic. So Scenic really, as a project, gives you two benefits. It gives you significant reduction in costs while maintaining or improving service levels, but it also gives you significant reduction in risk exposure. So we're using Scenic to take this risk exposure down, and that's a business call. That's why the agency directors have been involved in it. They all, one of their key responsibilities is to manage risk exposure for their organizations, and they all support this program, and they all signed a letter supporting this program that went to JLCIMT and was the basis for the e-board recommendation. All of them signed that letter, and we were very pleased to get that support from them, and we were able to explain it in non-technical terms so people can understand what we're talking about. What else?
What about software? Oh, let me back up for just a second, because you and I understand it. Actually, members, I would say that this is sort of, you know, job security for cybersecurity people, because taking an enterprise's size is not uncommon for them to take a couple of years to get all the security stuff in place. But then about that time, some of the stuff that you put in early starts becoming somewhat obsolete, outdated because of new attacks and a whole variety of other reasons, and so you end up kind of circling back around and start replacing some of the switches and routers and other things that you were doing at the beginning. So let me go back to my question of percentages. Do you think you're 30% there or?
Chair Kremel, yes, I guess if I had to give you a number, I'd say we're somewhere between 25-30% there. We are better than we were. We already have the ability to deal with situations that we could not have a few months ago. We certainly have got everybody's attention, and it's visible, and the agencies are engaged, and we're working together pretty well. You've been involved in developing some legislation that may go through that will also essentially changed the way we've approached security. In the past, it's been left up to the individual agencies pretty much to determine what level of resources and attention they should pay to this area. We now want to pursue this on an enterprise level where the agency actions occur within the context of the enterprise strategy.
And this is extremely important in that respect. So you actually have started expending dollars that were approved.
Yes, sir. They must all be expended by the end of biennium. But we will not spend them if we cannot spend them well. I mean, we're going to go as fast as we can go, but our goal is not to spend all the money. Our goal is to spend it wisely and get the results. And that's one of the reasons that we've kept this program out and extremely visible. We could have plowed the dollars into the Scenic cost pools, but we didn't want to do that. We wanted it to be extremely visible because there are benchmarks that we're watching closely in terms of what we should be spending to get from where we are to an effective program. The typical benchmark is 5-7% of total IT spending you will spend on your cybersecurity needs, okay? And that's quite a bit more than we've been spending historically.
Yes. I'd like you to address a little bit about hardware-software compatibility. And the reason why I'm asking this is that you know, one of the things that we know, for example, about IBM hardware is that some of the software that runs on your proprietary.
Right.
And so it stops you from being able. So if you get an IBM box that goes out on you, you basically have to replace it with another IBM box. You can't, because of the software and the proprietariness of the software. You can't move. So if another hardware vendor came in, for example, with a better price, all of the technical specs were met, but you can't make that switch because the software that you're using is only proprietary to one particular brand. So I'd like you to address that a little bit, Don.
Hey, Chair Grimmel, let me sort of start at the simplest level and move up where it's more complex. In terms of changing, for example, PC vendors, all the major PC manufacturers basically are assemblers, and they're putting together pretty much the same parts from pretty much the same suppliers, all right? And what really distinguishes them, some are a lot better at pricing and distribution and customer service than others and so forth. So in that particular area, in fact, the Smart Buy initiative that DAS pursued did end up changing some of our PC suppliers because we were able to secure much better pricing for the state. And in that area, that's more of a commodity piece of technology. We can deal with the fact that, that the motherboard is not on the right side of this box, it's on the left side and that kind of thing. So that that kind of hardware change and so forth is not a big deal. Where the compatibility issues become important is really when you get to the interaction of the operating system and the application layer. And that's one of the reasons that we don't change technology in a data center and network consolidation project. What we, in order to do the project safely and quickly, what we do basically is we create in the new data center a technical environment that looks exactly like the one that this stuff is running in now. So when we consolidate it, it really doesn't even know it was moved. So it works, and it doesn't break, and it works quickly. And then over time, we can take a second layer of savings by perhaps looking for getting rid of redundancy, and we've got the same similar products doing the same things where we could just have one. So we do that in subsequent stages. It turns out that some application software is written to take advantage of specific features or hooks in operating systems, which makes it very difficult to port it over to other platforms, and part of what you were talking about. It also turns out in the real world that you've got you've got open source, you've got open standards, okay, and you've got proprietary. And the strategy that the state is pursuing right now is that all of those three choices are on the table as we try to meet our needs. And we make the decision based on what we think is the most cost-effective and smartest choice for the state. It is, we do not see any one of those strategies as being the strategy that provides a complete solution. We believe if the state were to try to focus on one and not take advantage of the offerings from the other two, that it would not be in the state's best interest. Now, as time goes by, that may change, but currently you'll find a mixture of proprietary, open standards, and open source in the solution set that we buy to meet the state's needs. Okay? And the open standards thing, when two pieces of technology supposedly both meet a standard, that doesn't necessarily mean they'll work together. Right. Okay? So they kind of work together. Or maybe some of it works together. All right? And one of the things that happens when you build these really overly complex and diverse infrastructures like we have is you get the lowest common denominator. And some of the stuff that you pay an awful lot of money for and value as functionality, you don't get because it doesn't interoperate with the features and capabilities in the other systems. And so there's a lot to be said for the state of Oregon that has basically an administrative computing requirement that doesn't push the envelope of technology. I'm not talking about the universities. I'm just talking about us normal people that write memos and emails and do spreadsheet work. We don't need to have 55,000 different ways of doing it. In fact, we ought to have one. And we can save a lot of money, and we can make a much safer, more efficient and cost-effective use of information technology. It is an enabling function for the state, and that is the direction we're trying to move in. But it will take a little bit of time because we have this thing called the install base, and we are not going to just start throwing away stuff that works. But as we refresh technology and we move out of it, and as we can produce a business case that says that this is a smart way for us to go and spend our money, we've got to move to a simpler environment. And complexity is our enemy. It is exactly the worst thing for us to put into our computing and networking infrastructure unless we absolutely have to address legitimate business needs.
Okay. Are there any kind of situations where we buy equipment or buy software and then end up not using it for an extended period of time, and then we end up, before we've ever actually really used it or installed it, it has to be updated and upgraded and that sort of thing? And what kind of contract do we have with that?
Members of the committee, as a matter of knowledge, I don't know. If I had to guess, this is a very large and complex enterprise, the state of Oregon, and probably just about everything has happened somewhere, someplace in this enterprise. Do I think this is a regular, common problem? No. If that's what you're asking me, I don't think so. And certainly in terms of the major investments, they get an awful lot of scrutiny. We pay a lot of, as you well know, from PERS and MMIS and so forth. We can't look at every $5,000 project, but when they get up in the, close to a million or more, they get a lot of scrutiny. And we've working very well with the agencies, because they're just as interested as we are in making sure that those investments work and pay off for them. And I think we've got a pretty good working relationship with them. And as you know, Chair Kremel, we're taking steps to significantly improve our quality assurance and oversight efforts so that we don't have more PERS things. But do I think that people regularly buy technology around the place without really a clear idea of what it's for, whether or not they're going to use it, and then it just sits on a shelf and then becomes obsolete and never really gets deployed? No, I do not think that occurs with any significant probability in the state, but I certainly can't guarantee you it doesn't occur with some probability.
Well, all I can say is that I would certainly hope not.
Yes, me too.
Because we want to make sure that we get all of the value out.
I think everybody's watching there.
Are there any other Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, with regard to the comprehensive vulnerability audit that we went through this past year, any more indications that we've had information within our silos compromised?
Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, members of the committee, one of the problems that we had in the vulnerability assessment showed us was a major deficiency in the area of eyes and ears. The fact is that there were compromises occurring that no one knew were occurring. Now, when I mentioned to you earlier about that incident response team, the incident response team cannot be deployed if it doesn't know there's an attack underway. So one of the things that we've had to do as part of establishing a capability is to upgrade the eyes and ears. And that's happening as we speak. It is limited. Again, we're forced into a triage situation, so we do not have a comprehensive capability across the entire enterprise covering all network segments and all areas, but we have a significantly improved capability over what we did have. I would say this to you. I wouldn't be putting the priority on the incident response team if I did not think that compromises were continuing to occur and that we needed to pay a lot of attention to that area. And we are stepping up our monitoring activities. But beyond that, I'd rather talk with you privately.
I appreciate that. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Butler.
Given the complexity of the state systems and the propensity for folks to have very little to do, I'm not sure what they do for a real living on the outside that are making these attempts, really wouldn't your incident response team basically be working 24/7 because the attacks are coming on a basis of 24/7, as I understand it?
Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, members of the committee, that is an outstanding question. When they like to attack you is at 3 a.m. Sunday morning, when you have the least amount of people on board. Particularly the more sophisticated hackers are very aware that there are better times to attack you when you have less staff on board. It is a 24/7 activity. That is one of the reasons that we will probably be co-sourced in terms of a sourcing strategy, because you have to be open for business 24 hours a day if you're going to provide an effective defense. The state of Oregon can just not say we're going to defend ourselves between 8 and 5 Monday through Friday, and the rest of the time there's nobody here. So it's a 24/7 activity. And by the way, that is, I'm sure everybody knows, that really takes the costs up. When you've got to have really capable, talented people in place that know what they're doing and are prepared to respond on a 24/7 basis, and you've got to have people looking at those monitors and looking at the information that they're providing you 24/7, because what you really want to do, if you can, is you want to catch the attack before it starts. You want to spot the precursor actions, the reconnaissance missions, and so forth. And if you can discover where it's coming from, then you can block the attack. I also want to mention one other thing to you. 50-70% of all security incidents originate from within the institution.
30%.
50-70%. So if we are successful in blocking all, 100% of all hostile traffic coming in from the Internet, we're still not okay. We have to worry about that other internal risk.
Mr. Chair, there's about a question probably for yourself and staff. Does the state presently have in statute any sanctions for employees, or is it statutory or within our contract, or just what is it that we have relative to sanctions for employees who would attempt to go beyond the current their capacity, their legitimate capacity to involve themselves in internet activities with the internet?
Representative Butler, I don't know what kind of sanctions we may have, but that might be something for staff to look into. Okay. Don, I don't know if you're aware of anything in statute or not. I do know that one of the problems that you have are not only the attacks that occur from outside, but the attacks that occur right. from inside the enterprise as well.
Well, and that's the 50-70% of the attacks, as I understand it. But my concern is that. That we have, and I know that presently the law provides for fidelity kinds of insurances and those kinds of things. I guess my concern is that if we begin to have a greater incidence of attack from within, and I hesitate to call them attacks, probably much of that is just a breach to see how far they can really get within the system. But we need to have something in place that protects both the state of Oregon in these kinds of matters, as well as to protect other private employers and their systems where an employee would intentionally breach beyond the firewalls where they have no business going. It's an invasion of privacy, and this probably privacy issues that are being addressed on a nationwide basis, but I'm anxious that Oregon have something within its statutes that protects both the state as well as other private enterprise relative to that that concern. And my final question, Mr. Chair, was just an update on the status of the PERS migration from their systems. I've forgotten the name of their most recent and the one that we were abandoning, but I would...
RIMS. Replacement of RIMS.
Yeah.
Chair Cremel, Representative Butler, members of the committee, could I respond to the previous point you were making for just a second?
Sure. Now, you come from private industry, Don. You should know what there might be out there from national, but it'd be interesting to know if Oregon has kept pace with that.
Well, there's a real problem, as you point out. You're making a really excellent point. There's a real problem with an enterprise that does not make reasonable efforts to secure its infrastructure, and its systems get compromised either by its own employees or by hackers coming in from the outside, and then those systems are used as launching pads to attack some other enterprise. That negligence can be quite costly. And there have been legal actions, significant ones, because the enterprise that functioned as a launching PAD was found to be negligent. And so it really goes beyond a matter of privacy so much as it goes into as being part of this internet community. We're transacting an awful lot of business across this networking infrastructure, and that the ability to secure that and for people to make reasonable efforts to see to it that their systems are safe and so forth is a responsibility that is being recognized in law that everybody has that participates in it. With respect to us, Oregon, what I'm aware of is a couple of things. We have been working on and have, I believe, deployed within DAS a what is called an acceptable use policy. And it tries to lay out, look, we recognize there'll be a certain amount of personal activity that'll occur on this infrastructure, but that it has to have certain boundaries to it, and that this stuff is there primarily for business uses, legitimate business uses of the state. And so what kinds of things can't you do? Okay, well, you know, some of the traffic that sometimes comes in from the internet is not appropriate and is not allowed. And so what the thing tries to do is to get at kind of what you might call the waste, fraud, and abuse area. Now, this House Bill 3145, if it goes into effect, there will be a set of administrative rules that will have to be developed in order to meet the direction from that law. And I think that's where you would find a lot of this stuff. For example, we will have to preclude people from installing hacker tools on machines. It cannot be allowed in the state of Oregon. So if those tools are found on someone's machine, that should have consequences. Okay, once the policy is clearly articulated and the education has occurred and the appropriate involvement of human resources and so forth, which clearly have to be an integral part of this process, but those kinds of activities we cannot allow. But we also have to be very clear to the people that work for us that those activities are not okay. So you're right about things. We need to get more formal. Stuff needs to go into writing. And quite honestly, everybody has to take some responsibility for helping secure the state's computing and networking infrastructure. I mean, if you can see some of this use yourself that shouldn't be occurring. We don't have to have it detected through some sort of really fancy, sophisticated technology. So there's simple things we can be doing now to try to make things safer. But your points are absolutely excellent. And do we have in place the human resource policies and the punitive consequences and so forth? No, but we do have an acceptable use policy that's being, I would say, piloted in DAS and based on, and I think the agencies have received copies of it. And we would recommend, depending on our own practical experience with it, that it become an enterprise kind of thing and be kind of common across the state. I also think, though, that it doesn't go far enough in terms of stuff. For example, there is illegal activity. It's not just that we don't want you to do it. It's against the law. These kinds of things have to go into writing, and they have to be defined, because some people don't even realize that some of the stuff is illegal.
Before you go on, if I may, Mr. Chair, before you go on to the PERS issues, yes. So for the record, it's clear, Don, that the state presently has a clearly articulated policy, and DAS has the authority presently to, with the statutes that are in place at present, to continue to articulate the policy as it evolves, so as to continue to protect the state from any of the kinds of cyber hacking that will develop out of this, because I think we're at the Marconian end of this whole process.
Right. Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, members of the committee, I believe. And I have supported House Bill 3145 because I do believe that it would be helpful to have more specific statutory authority and basis that is more contemporary and is based on a better understanding of where we're trying to go and what we think we need. And I believe that bill captures that. I also believe that the state does not have a lot of experience in managing a computing and networking infrastructure that's across the entire state, nor does it have that much experience in securing it. So I think that we should expect there will be a lot of iterations on the law and the administrative rules that we will find that we need over time, and maybe some of the things we write we'll find aren't so helpful. So I think this is going to be an area that's going to occupy some of our attention together before we've got the law and the administrative rules in place that are modern and contemporary and relevant to the kinds of things that we need to manage here in security.
And the status of 3145?
House Bill 31.
Pardon?
I'll have to check.
I think 3145 is over in the Senate. We passed it. That was a bill that I carried on the floor about 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
It came out of the Information Management Technology Committee on the House side and is now over in the Senate, and there's some discussions that are going on relative to it.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
And I think just my comment, Mr. Chair, relative to hacking, I think at 3 a.m. Sunday morning on December the 7th, 1941, is when the Japanese pilots were mustered to attack Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So probably a good time of the day to be careful. I'm sorry, you were just getting ready to go on the PERS issue.
Chair Kremer, Representative Butler, members of the committee. With respect to the PERS issue, I think we have a, I'm not sure how many briefings you've had on this, but JLCINT had quite a bit of reviews on this. I think the situation in PERS is substantially, dramatically improved. I think we have, first of all, the right strategy. We have the right people leading the strategy. And they're making a combined effort here there is some enhancement activity that was going against RIMS because you could not replace it in time. But the replacement strategy uses the same technology as they used for the... Bill, what is the new... it's J-Clarity. It's Covance's J-Clarity. What was the new retirement program? HB
2020. Oh,
well,
I didn't know that.
Anyway, there was a that technology was purchased and employed to deal with the new program, and it will be the same technology but adapted differently to replace RIMS. And that makes sense because that will have a coherent and consistent technical strategy that's common across our retirement programs, and they are moving in what I would call a deliberate and careful fashion. I personally am very comfortable that they know what they're doing and that we agree with and have carefully reviewed the strategy, and we believe that the leadership that they've got there is on the ball, knows what they're doing, and of course we're interacting with them on a regular basis.
Great. And Mr. Chair, just a final follow-up on the PERS. We're not experiencing the failure that we were told we were probably going to experience last session in with the RIM system.
Well, Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, it's one of these things where it was a high-risk thing. The fact it didn't kill us yet doesn't mean that tomorrow it might not. So, I mean, this thing needs to be replaced.
Yeah.
And they're working on it.
The RIMS is state-of-the-art technology from the 1950s, though.
Perhaps, but it helps when there's no document, and it doesn't help when the documentation's not very good either. So,
thank you.
Are they kind of following up on that, Don? Is public employee retirement staff starting to be able to move more and more away from their manual workarounds that they've had to do and that sort of thing as they're continuing to migrate over to the J-Clarity product?
Chair Carl, members of the committee. The real, as I understand, a human resource issue there are the subject matter experts, and that they get, because of lack of RIMS functionality, they're constantly engaged manually in dealing. So that's why some of the enhancements to RIMS are occurring, so they can free up the subject matter experts so they can be deployed against the replacement strategy. Okay, so yes, that's happening. I think the morale is up. I think the IT organization is being turned around. It was a big problem and a big effort, but I think that the management there has been really quite good, and they're turning it around.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don, I just had a question about what I think is sort of a unique problem that we face in state government, and that's records retention because of the need to preserve records for a long time, dealing with public records requests. Does that pose any unique security problems for us? And also, I'm curious because of your comment earlier about that we, things don't have to be as complicated as we have made them. Is there any effort to streamline the records retention process so that it isn't being handled agency by agency in some unique way?
Vice Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, there's actually been quite a bit of discussion about records retention, particularly more and more we have documents that never were hard copy. They were electronic for their entire lifetime. And we recognize that we have to have the ability to manage both the hard copy documents and increasingly the electronic documents. And we need to have a policy that spans the enterprise. All right? And we need to be able to not only retain but recover the documents. There's not much point in retaining them if you can't get them. And there's some issues with respect to email. And how email should be treated, and so there's quite a bit of activity underway on that right now. With respect to streamlining that particular area, I think we're more looking for the strategy, the policies, how we're going to use email, what are we going to do for archiving in terms of email. I mean, some people have enormous email inventories that quite impressive. It puts quite a load on the system sometimes. I would be happy to come back at some future time and perhaps or arrange for a better briefing for you on that. But the best answer I can give right now, yeah, there's quite a bit of activity in that area, and that is an area of concern. From a security point of view, I don't know that it represents any. Well, of course, we had Iron Mountain the other day had a little problem, which is where sometimes these documents get stored, and they had some, information leak out that shouldn't have leaked out. But from a security point of view, clearly, we more and more we'll be dealing with this electronically. We'll be transmitting documents across the internet to other facilities where they will be archived and stored and then recovered, and that process needs to. Needs to have security capabilities depending on the content of the document. We may not want to send some of the stuff across as open text across the internet and so forth, but I think our main problem right now is trying to come up with the policies for how we're going to deal with email and what is its status going to be. Roy Turner, yeah. State Archivist has been involved. We've had several meetings with him. The CIO Council has been looking at this, and I could certainly provide you a better status report than I'm giving you right now, but I can tell you there's quite a bit of activity in that area.
Well, we could schedule that, Jim, if you would schedule that with Don to come back and kind of give us a briefing on the information storage and retention and security and the questions that Representative Rosenbaum was asking about. That'd be good.
Mr. Chair, I'd give if I offered to give a nickel for every document that's on my computer right now that I can't recover, I'd be a very poor man by the end of the day because I've got so much information. But you think I would want it obliterated and removed from my computer? No, those are documents that I wrote years and years and years ago.
You may need them.
And I may need them. Now, I can't access them, but I may need them someday. So I refuse to allow them to be ripped off of my computer. But this issue of what I originally had with an IBM typewriter printing out, with a ball printer on it, the word processing that I did 20 years ago, I've long since given up on that. That stuff doesn't continue to roll over. But from the last migration, that stuff has rolled over and those computer programs are locked. And I'm saying, gee, I wish I could get that, but I haven't needed it for the last 2 years, so I guess I'll just leave it there until I...
Right. But you might.
The next migration, at which point everything that I'm doing now will be locked up.
Right.
And accessible for retained documents that can't be recovered. So
there's people out there that have businesses that do that kind of stuff.
I know. So I say, if I offered a nickel for every document, I couldn't get
it. They won't charge you that much.
Let it on my computer, I'd go broke.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Don? Don, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bill, I'm going to ask you if we can push off the assessment until Tuesday. The reason being is that I would like to, with the full committee here, and we're going to run out of time. I would like to get to the DEQ portion. So, would you object if I put you off until Tuesday? Is that all right? Okay, great. What I would ask, though, members, is that this information that's been passed out to you relative to the assessments and user fees and that sort of thing, that you bring that back with you on Tuesday. And I'm sure everyone, including myself, will probably forget, but we can give it a shot here.
Mr. Chair, just a point of information. The black and white Xerox copy of the photocopy that you received actually is the same thing you received in color. The color is just a lot easier to read for the
yes.
purpose of explanation. So they're the same chart. One is just front and back.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your patience. Appreciate it. Okay. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the DAP subject. I'm going to open a discussion on the DEQ recommendation draft. Members, you have before you a draft that I've worked on putting out relative to the hearings that we had with the joint hearing that we had with the Environment Committee in Sherwood. There are, and I've tried to edit this and make sure that it's, you know, pretty correct and that sort of thing. I think that probably the big thing to get to are the recommendations. Now, we do have Andy Ginsberg here in the audience, and he has also submitted to us some written comments. If there are questions that you have for Andy, I certainly wouldn't hesitate to ask him to come forward. The recommendations start at the middle of page 3 and then go on to page 4. I think we heard a lot of accolades for DEQ and the vehicle inspection program and how they operate it and some of the customer service things that have occurred. But I think that there the issues that were brought up by Dr. Adams, I think are significant from a standpoint of the calibrations of the equipment. And the validity of the calibrations and some of the other components with the testing equipment. Now, granted, DEQ is asking for authority to move away from the enhanced tests in the Portland area, and that is the area that Dr. Adams had the issue with. But I think in the other area, even in the basic tests, I think that it's very important that the calibrations are correct and accurate. So what I've suggested here is that we would send a note over to Ways and Means, and that they attach a budget note that would require a contract with a third party to actually look over. As you know, and you heard in the testimony, DEQ asserts that the Adams report is flawed, that his statistical analysis is not accurate and it's not correct. Dr. Adams asserts that he got the information from DEQ, and he used their information and then put a statistical analysis to it, and that's how he came up with his report. So what we sort of have here are, you know, dueling experts.
Dueling experts.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So what and that's why I would suggest in here this contract with a third party that's not been
previously associated with DEQ, and also it's not associated with, it's not been associated with Adams. Because I think that having someone take a look at this, look at the two reports, say yes, and it, you know, it certainly is not within my realm, and I don't know if anybody else on here other than maybe Representative Butler would be expert enough to really evaluate those two reports. If the what we're suggesting here then is that if the Adams report truly is flawed, that there be a second step in this, and that second step would be to have an audit done by an expert third party that can look at the calibrations, and I'm suggesting that statistical analysis should show that the calibrations and the equipment is operating within the 0.05 level of confidence. Now, I don't know if that's possible. Maybe that's too high, but I would like to see it, you know, have an expert that would come in and tell us that, and that the audit analysis should be station to station and lane to lane, and then also looking at the calibrations that are automatically performed and the statistical reliability of the data that the calibrations and the equipment is actually producing. And I know one of the things that, you know, DEQ talks about are people that, you know, pass one at one station and fail at another, or fail at one station and pass at another, that their auto is probably sort of in that mid-range where, you know, at any given time it could pass or fail. The only issue that I have with that is that if when it's consistent, as it appears. And I say appears to have been in the Adams situation when he was taking his personal car through and sort of spurred him on or motivated him to do this further analysis. But at the same time, the way automobiles are getting now and the sophistication that they have in their motors and their onboard systems, but even before onboard systems were in place, is the sophistication within the motors. I really have to question whether or not, you know, how what the incidence of that really is. Now, obviously, if you have a vehicle that's not been maintained, you know, oil hasn't been changed, and you know, variety it hasn't been tuned, and you know, those sorts of things, they're not going to operate efficiently, and they're not going to operate correctly, and they probably are going to fail because of their emissions. And
but Mr. Chair, really, a question here isn't necessarily the automobile; it's the equipment that we're using for the DEQ testing of these VIP programs, is it
correct?
Not?
Correct.
Have we contacted the manufacturer? Has DEQ contacted the manufacturer? What are the tolerances guaranteed? We need to probably take a look at the guaranteed tolerances in the machinery that we're in the process of purchasing. Looks like to me that we probably have a defect or a potential defect. And as you say, there may be a tolerance, as brought out by Dr. Adams. But this is not unique to Oregon equipment. I think many, many, many states, particularly those with basins and high driving areas, have access to this equipment. Maybe DEQ's been buying the wrong equipment, or equipment that is now antiquated, or may have other problems. So I'm just concerned about possibility that we take a look at the parameters of the equipment that are presently employed by the department.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for DEQ. I'm wondering if we might be able to have Andy come up here.
Sure. Andy, why don't you come up?
Thank you, Andy.
Go ahead, Representative.
The question I had is, and you know, I found that the tour really enlightening, and although I had toured my own, actually the Northeast station was the one that I know Mr. Adams had supposedly failed repeatedly, so I was glad, as I mentioned before, that my car passed when it went through there. However, I guess I had a couple of questions and about this recommendation and wanted to clarify with Andy. Can you give us a time frame about when this, the test, because I know it was the enhanced test that had the biggest question that were raised about when those will be phased out.
Chair Kremel, Representative Dinkfelder, we're beginning the phase out now of the enhanced test, and it will be completed during this coming biennium, during 2007.
Okay, so just a follow-up question, Mr.
Follow-up.
The concern that I had, and I certainly agree that we need to make sure that the equipment's being calibrated correctly and that we're not making people go through tests repeated time when it's actually not the car's fault, but the equipment. But it sounds like that's where most of the issues from, you know, listening to Dr. Adams' testimony was with the enhanced tests. Is that correct?
Chair Kremel, Representative Dinkfelder, yes, Dr. Adams' concern was with the enhanced test, but I just would like to correct, it's not most of the issues. With the statistical analysis that we did showed that the equipment performed flawlessly for literally millions of tests, and the issues that Dr. Adams raised affected 250 vehicles out of about 30 million that we've tested. It was a one-time problem that we had. It's something that we corrected. It's something that won't happen again. So even with the existing equipment that we have, there really isn't a problem. But having said that, we are phasing out this equipment. The remaining majority of the tests will be done with the onboard diagnostics test, which is really just reading the car's computer. So there's no calibration required. There's no analyzer. There's no gas flow. There's nothing that needs to be calibrated. It's reading information off the car's computer. And by 2007, that will be affecting, that's the test we'll use for about 75% of the vehicles. As the chair said, the remaining 25% will be tested with the basic test. And that does have a calibration, but it's much, much simpler than the enhanced test. It doesn't involve a dynamometer. It doesn't involve a continuous airflow system. It only tests for one pollutant. It's measuring concentration, not total volume of pollutants. So it's much simpler to operate, and it will be up on a small and declining portion of the vehicles.
So one final question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the question I have is, have you looked into how much an audit would cost? And I guess I have a concern about, since we're phasing out these tests anyway, spending, you know, a high amount of, and this would be not general fund money, but I'm assuming the money is coming from, you know, when I go to get my car tested and I'm paying into the fee, that would be part of it. So I guess I'm looking for the cost-benefit analysis of the fact that we're phasing out these tests and how much do we want to invest. You know, is there a way that we can do a reduced sort of, you know, narrow the scope of analysis without spending, I mean, I know audits are expensive, spending a lot of money in a system that's going to be phased out in a few years?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dinkfelder, I have contacted Portland State University, and I'm in the process of establishing an interagency agreement with them to do exactly that, because of the questions that have been raised by Dr. Adams and the situation that we're now in, where it's become kind of a dueling experts scenario. I think it is important to have a third-party review, but I think that could be done really simply and efficiently with some professors from the university, Portland State University and the College of Urban and Public Studies. They have expertise in statistical analysis, and for probably less than $10,000 could do a review of Dr. Adams' report and our report and give a pretty good picture of whether or not there's any validity to his concerns.
Another question, final, is can you tell us what the time frame of that review would be if PSU or whoever's going to do it, and then versus an audit, and how much, if you've looked into how much a full-blown audit would cost? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of, you know, the investment of that for a technology that we're going to be phasing out in a short amount of time.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Dinkfelder, I've asked Portland State University if they can get us a report back in June. I think it would be useful. The Ways and Means Committee may still be meeting, and it would be useful for them to have the information. I think if we get into a full-blown audit, it will be something that will go on, you know, well into next biennium. The recommendation that you're considering contemplates quarterly reports of the Joint Legislative Audits Committee, so I'm presuming that the idea would be to have, you know, a year or two long process. One of my concerns with that is that during this time we'll be dismantling the enhanced test, we'll be replacing all of the equipment in the basic and the onboard diagnostics test, and we'll be piloting our two new innovative tests that I talked about at the last hearing, the online testing and the self-service testing. So I'm anticipating my engineers being fully engaged in that activity, and that's what I'd like to do, if possible, a one-step, fairly quick audit just to verify that what we said about Dr. Adams' report is correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I had a concern about the cost, spending that amount of money for a full-blown audit, when my understanding from attending the tour and listening to the testimony was that this technology was going to be phased out. And the question is still, you know, whether... And, you know, I feel like we want to resolve the issue with Dr. Adams, and maybe having a narrowed scope of review might be one way to do that without costing, you know, whatever, $300,000 or $400,000 for an audit. I mean, my concern is that we're going to be investing a lot of money in a process that we're phasing out.
Well, there's two things that Andy had made the suggestion about that I put in number one, and I thought it was a good suggestion of having a third party to kind of take a look at it first before we just moved into an audit type of situation. I guess the only question that I'm going to ask is that, have you contracted with Urban Studies before? Are they going to be an unbiased entity not associated with DEQ? That's a question that I just have to ask. If they have, you know, not that I don't trust Portland State, not that I, you know, I'm not trying to put a black mark on any of our academic institutions, but what I'm trying to make sure of is, because if you've got professors there that you have worked with before, number one, I'm not so sure how unbiased they're going to be, and number two is that I just want to be sure that it's somebody that, you know, is not familiar with, other than maybe taking their own car through the system. But I think that's an important question. The other thing is that this recommendation just contemplates that the only, you know, if the Adams report is shown to be flawed, as DEQ has asserted, you know, basically, then it's done. I mean, I'm not suggesting that they go back. But the other thing is, I also don't want us making the same mistakes over again at some point in the future. I recognize that the look back on the enhanced test, everybody kind of says, well, you know, why bother? Because we're phasing that out. But I think there's also the calibrations relative to the basic tests. And as we're, because my understanding is there's going to be updating of that equipment and that software and that sort of thing also. Well, let's make sure that it's accurate, and that's one of the reasons why I mentioned the lane to lane and the station to station. Let me put you on hold for a second. Representative Butler, Representative Brown has a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Dingfelder's pretty well stated my case and my concern with it. Why are we going down the road to evaluate a system that we're no longer in the process, we're no longer, and equipment also that we're no longer going to use or utilize to a great, you know, lesser extent, that my concern would be more that new equipment, the new tests are being implemented properly, and so maybe we're testing the wrong procedures and wrong equipment.
Okay.
But Mr. Chair, in reading recommendation number one, it doesn't ask for a test or an audit of the equipment. It talks about an audit of the testing protocols used to ensure the pass-fail rate of emissions testing, that it is accurate. So we're really not proposing to test the equipment as much as we are the protocols overall, just to reiterate, I would be concerned personally about selecting someone in the academia market in Portland to come and express this unbiased entity opinion on behalf of DEQ. I don't know that I could go there with someone in that market, but I do want to call out that the audit is of the testing protocols, not the equipment.
Okay.
Sure.
Not to get into a debate about where we're going to, but tell me at the end of the day, when we get, we do this, we go through this, we do these audits, what are we going to do with it?
Well, hopefully, what we're going to do, with this information is that it points DEQ in the in the direction from a standpoint of making sure that where there's calibrations required, that the calibrations are accurate, so that when someone pulls their car through and they've failed or passed, that we really know that they have failed or passed. Now, granted, with the onboard diagnostics and that sort of thing, there is of course not a question of the calibration, because the computer is going to, quite frankly, report what it reads in the from the onboard system. And so there is no calibration there, but I think as long as even the basic test is being used, we need to make sure that the calibrations are correct. So, I mean, you know, if we but I think and that's where I see the value of the look back with this, and like I mentioned, the lane to lane analysis. If we don't want to have them look at the enhanced lanes, then don't look at the enhanced lanes. Yes, Representative.
I was going to say, I have no problem hiring somebody from Eastern Oregon to come out and do the third-party analysis.
Treasure Valley
community. Yeah, from some area that doesn't do testing.
Mr. Chair, to respond to that this is not rocket science. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, that this is something that's done nationwide. If there are other there are other agencies that are involved in this in another state, if you could just pull or private industry. This is something that's typically provided. I mean, the states that I've lived in while I was going to school and starting out work in other places before I returned back home, this is done by private industry in most other states. To have the state run the exclusive program and those kinds of things is, I guess I'm surprised to see that we're still in the business, because I thought last session that we were going to make a study to see, you know, how long the state could stay in this business when private industries could come to the table and take over this kind of business, where we wouldn't be having these kinds of problems. As a matter of fact, this was the kind of problem that other states said that this would be where the state of Oregon should continue to run their program, because you will have the greater oversight over a program that's state run than you will from a privately run operation. Probably Mr. Ginsburg remembers those discussions from one of those prior sessions.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to add that since I sat through hours of that testimony last session, the reason that we didn't pursue the privatization was because there wasn't ample evidence that it could be done less expensively. And that there, at that point, we hadn't had any issues that had been brought to us with this. I mean, most of the testimony we heard, and I know you couldn't be there, but very positive testimony about the type of service. So, you know, I think it was shown that we could deliver the service cost effectively. But regardless if it's done private or publicly, you still need to have some type of third party assurance and, you know, make sure that all the equipment's being calibrated. So.
And that's what I see the auditing is that the auditing is the testing of the protocols that are utilized. And Representative Dingfelder, my recollection, when you looked at this last session, and I wasn't a part of that discussion, but at that time there was a fairly substantial reserve that the DEQ was holding as a backup. I see that reserve has dwindled now down considerably from where it was. So when we talk about the fact that private industry couldn't do it, you know, for whatever reason, cheaper, better, faster, looks like we've used up some of our reserve. That's very interesting to see that number. Mm-hmm.
So are you suggesting then that we modify the first recommendation on this? That I guess first of all, talking about the audit of the testing protocols, I used the wrong nomenclature there, so we need to.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess what I would like to see, if there could be agreement on this, is that we agree to do the initial review without necessarily jumping the gun on that and asking for a full-blown audit, which sounds like it could be quite expensive. Sure. Because if it turns out after that review, and it's, you know, no concern of mine whether it's done publicly or privately, but by somebody that has the ability to evaluate objectively, and it turns out that there's no validity to Professor or Dr. Adams' concerns, then we don't need to go down this road. And it sure sounds like that could probably be done while we're still in session, you know, so I don't see a need for...
One of the things, now this calls for the Department of Administrative Services to contract with that, with an entity. Andy has said that he's moving forward, you know, just on his own out of the agency, you know, having the DEQ agency do it. Any thoughts on that?
Depends on how much DAS charges for that.
They would just be administering or doing the contract. But I don't know. They may end up charging DEQ as much as the contractor would charge, and then you know, end up with double the cost. I don't know.
But I just want to second Representative Rosenbaum's suggestion. I think that's a good compromise, and that it moves it forward, and then we can look at what the results of that first phase of the review are and decide whether or not we need to go forward with a more in-depth audit.
One of the suggestions that had been made to me by Andy was that we just have that process and progress overlooked by the Joint Legislative Audits Committee during the interim, so that once this first initial look is done, JLAC is who would sort of say, yeah, there needs to be more work done or not. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a good approach.
Mr. Chair, I would certainly be supportive of that. While an audit, quote unquote, may not be necessary here, the whole issue of testing the protocols, or at least some examination of the protocols used to ensure that pass-fail rate of emissions, I would think that there ought to be some ability to arrive at that excuse me, within the machinery company itself, the mm-hmm. provider of that, but I'm anxious that you arrive at some kind of a conclusion that will not destroy the testing program, but that will assure that the testing is in place, the protocols are in place to make sure that the testing is accurate and uniform throughout all of the program.
Well, and I think that's what the major goal of this is to just make sure, you know, sure. We've been called into question. And, the one thing is, government does a crappy job of letting people know that the services that we provide really are valuable and that there's a value add. And then when we get something like this occurring, you know, the mentality of government is to hunker down and protect and set up the fortress, as opposed to saying, okay, we're gonna make this transparent, we're gonna go out and we're going to we're willing to be put under scrutiny, and if we find that we're wrong, you know, that we don't have the value add, that we're not providing a valuable service here, or that you know this is all just sort of the scientific bunk or non-scientific bunk, you know, we're willing to change it. And I think, we've been called into serious question. When I say we, I mean the state of Oregon and the DEQ vehicle inspection program in particular has been called into question very seriously. It's been picked up by the media. It has been run with by the media for quite some time now. And our mentality has been, well, we're gonna set up the fortress. Well, anyway, that's
Mr. Chair. That's exactly the reason why I would think that it would be very, very important that the entity with which DEQ would contract to have this protocol examination and testing done should absolutely bear every resemblance of a totally independent outside organization. As a matter of fact, I don't know who the agency was that made the bids last time, but maybe those ought to be the folks, they were from out of state, maybe those ought to be the folks that you could contact and say, you know, can you come in and do the testing on some machinery and tell us if we're doing it right?
Maybe that would be a, maybe, I don't know. But I do, for that very reason, I do call in, for that very reason, is one of the reasons why I do call into question, you know, going to Portland State, yeah. Urban Studies Department.
Yeah.
How unbiased are they going to be? All right, let me move on here.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
We're on the floor at 10 o'clock today.
Yes, we are. We'll be done here in a minute. With regards to the other recommendations, are there any thoughts? We are recognizing that the self-service and using online for OBD, and suggesting to Ways and Means that they that be accelerated as much as possible, and the pilot be set up as the department has talked about doing. Also looking at the fees, we're suggesting that they look at it, because one of the things that the department had said was that the reason for the increased fees in the Portland area was because of the enhanced tests. Those are going away, they're gone. So suggesting that they take a look at the fees with regards to Portland and Medford and try to align those more closely.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was just reading Andy's testimony, and I guess I would like to hear more about what would happen about the reduction in the Portland fee. If you can explain what it's in your written testimony, that would be helpful.
Right. Chair Crummell, Representing Felder, just really briefly, because I know you have to go, last time we raised the fee was in 1997, and as Representative Butler pointed out, our reserve is dwindling. We have a $3 million capital project. We'll be doing this next biennium, and our current annual expenditures exceed our revenue because we exempted newer vehicles from the test recently, and so we are probably looking at needing to do a fee increase in the 07-09 biennium. My plan all along has been, at that time when we look at the fee increase, to completely look at the structure of the fee. We won't be doing the enhanced tests in Portland anymore, so there's no reason for the differential between Portland and Medford, except that Medford probably does have a lower lease rate. It's a building we've been in for a long time. So we would look at that time at setting a fee that reflected the cost in Medford versus the cost in Portland. But the only issue that I have with recommendation number three is that it presumes a reduction in fee, which I don't think is likely to happen. And so, you know, the idea of restructuring, I think, would be a better term, because we do need to look at the relative fees of Portland and Medford.
Okay. Other questions? With regards to number four, just suggesting that they study the idea of exempting cars that are 20 years or older because of the fact that they are such a small part, becoming a small part of the fleet that's in use. And then number five is with the advances in technology in motor vehicles, suggesting that autos will be a declining contributor as DEQ starts negotiations with EPA on their updated 10-year maintenance plan. They should consider reducing the percentage of the plan currently devoted to vehicle emission, so that the vehicle emission program or testing program is eliminated in the next 20 years or in 20 years.
Mr. Chair, I know we're trying to get out of here, but I had a couple of questions for Andy regarding that, because
that's fine.
My understanding, and you know, I'm not an air quality expert, but I have worked quite a bit with the Clean Air Act, is that aren't the older vehicles often the biggest polluters or the biggest part of the problem? So I'm concerned about saying let's exempt the older vehicles, because a lot of times they're the ones like to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, in my testimony I provided some information about that. We actually, the chair is correct that it's a small percentage of vehicles, about 6% of vehicles that are over 20 years old that we currently test, but they contribute a disproportionate share of the emissions. They have a much higher failure rate. They have about a 34% failure rate relative to a 9% failure rate for newer vehicles. So they, even though they're only 6% of the vehicles, they account for 20% of the overall failures and even more of the emissions, because their failures tend to be gross failures of a major system like a catalytic converter. So about 25% of the emission reduction we get from cars that fail the test and are then repaired come from that exact population. So DEQ would not support exempting the older vehicles. There's also a big equity issue for people who have newer cars that are better maintained, and they see their neighbor with an older car that's allowed to be smoky just because it happens to be over 20 years old. So DEQ is not in favor of that particular approach. And in terms of the newer vehicles, we did recently exempt, we only used to exempt vehicles that were 2 years old, and we expanded it to the first 4 years. If you go beyond that, you start running into some significant issues, which is, number one, those vehicles can be higher mileage, so they start tending to have more failures of their emission control systems. And you can see, if you look at our data, you can see a jump in the failure rates right after year four. But on top of that, the warranties started running out, and it's very important for us to catch the failures while the warranty period are still on. Otherwise, customers come in their sixth, seventh, or, you know, in this case, it would be their ninth year. Warranties are expired, major equipment failures, and they have to pay for the repairs themselves. So in this terms of this particular item of the recommendations, the department wouldn't support going there. And if I could just mention real briefly on number five, that our concern with that is that if we don't address vehicle emissions over time, what ends up happening is the emissions from motor vehicles will increase. We do have increasing population. That means more cars. Everyone's driving more miles, so that's the growth in miles traveled is growing even faster than population. So if we don't continue to maintain the vehicles, what happens is we use up some of the airshed, which would otherwise be available for industrial growth. And, you know, a lot of our program has been about trying to make sure we don't squander that resource, that we have plenty of room in the airshed for new industry and employment. And that's why the industry has been so supportive of our maintenance plan and has been very helpful to us in terms of supporting the vehicle inspection program. So I know that they wouldn't be in favor of scaling back the vehicle inspection program. What ends up happening is we transfer regulation from motor vehicles onto the industry then.
Okay. Are your questions answered?
Yeah.
Okay.
Based on that, I do have concerns with number four and five for the reasons they express. I mean, my understanding is, I was going to ask about modeling that DEQ does or has to do to show there's projections, because I do know that cars are running cleaner, but because there's an increase in the amount of vehicle period over time, I'd like to see the, you know, what the trend is. If you can provide us that information, that would be really helpful, because that's the questions I had about number five. You just talked about that.
Chair, we can definitely do that. The declining trend in emissions per car is pretty much offset by the increase in miles traveled, and we can provide that.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum?
I guess my concern would just be, it seems like four and five do sort of go off a little beyond what the scope was of our hearing and what we were really looking at, and I wonder whether it might be better that the Environment Committee should take that issue up and take a look at whether they wanted to move in that direction rather than cloud the audit of the testing equipment with that.
That's
since I'm a member of the Environment.
Hand that off to the Environment.
Yeah, looking for more work over there.
Sort of hand off to the Environment Committee. That's not a bad. That's a good suggestion.
Yeah, I would second that, because
I will say this, and I, you know, with all due respect to Andy and the work that the department does on some of these, you know, we're not necessarily here to do the rubber stamping and the work that the department wants, but rather the work that the citizens of the state of Oregon want. And I think that when we give, I appreciate the fact that, for example, on number four, the department wouldn't support that, but I don't expect the department to support everything we do anyway.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I do agree that it is our job to review the work of the agencies. However, I do know that I don't think the citizens of my district, where we do have a lot of older cars, would support not having inspections because of the concern for air quality. I've seen it. I have a lot of older cars in my district, and the concern is that they do burn. You know, they don't burn as clean as newer cars, so I had a concern about exempting them.
I have experienced it myself, having worn out a car that couldn't pass DEQ anymore, so I sold it to a guy in Klamath Falls.
I sold it to a guy in Northeast Portland, but she wasn't my district.
And it's a good thing that the program wasn't statewide at that point.
Yeah.
Okay, any other comments about the about this report? I'll go back and do some further editing on it, and I'll bring it back on Tuesday. Thank you. With that, I will close the informational hearing and we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We missed the bag part.